Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Bowlology Report. Daniel Fleming here. Very excited. Very excited about special guest. He's a man who is a former Australian test cricketer. He's treasurer of the fast bowling cartel. Former Cricket Australia board member. He's got a master's in business because he's smart. He's an ex-fast bowler. He's got three lovely children, lovely wife, Lindsay, one of the most loved teammates of our era. And a man named by Wisden as the person, the cricketer, who saved test match cricket back at Edgbaston 2005. Michael Kasprich, thanks for joining us.
Well, mate, hello, Flam. How are you? Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, mate, thanks for joining us. Now, straight away, are you comfortable with that claim that you are the man who saved test match cricket?
Well, I think it's appropriate, really. It's 16 years ago that, being an Ashes year, of course, this summer, that we need to bring it up again, the fact that I single-handedly saved Test cricket.
Take us through those moments, that split second, two to win, Harmison's running in, and how quickly was it? Did you just know you're out and just straight away, I've got to walk?
Well, in the flurry, you know, I suppose instinct takes over. Yeah, you practice plenty of short balls, get away, you wear it and all that. But just in the moment, it felt like it rose off a length that was a lot tighter and instinct's hands sort of went up like that. And I like to think it was good coaching or practice, but it meant that in that moment I was able to actually drop my right hand off the bat at the time and it flicked the right hand, which happened to be off the bat. And of course, we all know that law 34.1 MCC laws of cricket clearly states that's not out.
But did you know instinctively not out, but you were thinking for world cricket, we've dominated the Poms for 25 years. Test cricket's at its strongest. It was the biggest rating Ashes series ever. And you were a part of it. Did you just think, this is bigger than me? This is bigger than the country.
I actually had a guy in India. I happened to be in a hotel lobby in India, and a guy came up to me and just said, he says, "Oh, hey, Michael Kasprich, thank you. Thank you for saving Test cricket." And I said, "Oh, how did we manage that, mate?" And this is obviously in India, and he's loving his cricket. And he just said, "Well, if you had have got those runs with Brett Lee, you would have been 2-0 up in the series, and Australia would have gone and won it, and then Test cricket would be boring. But your innings actually saved it." And the classic part about it, Flem, is that you pointed out that there was junior participation rates were up by 30% in both countries. There was DVD.
They're buying bats.
Mate, the greatest test was the DVD was sold for, I think, £11.99 or 30,000 copies of that. There was all the England players all got MBEs, including the bus driver. And if I was the guy who was single-handedly responsible, what do you reckon happened to me?
Are you knighted?
I got dropped again. So that was it. So
so world cricket's happy. The Queen's happy. She's knighting people. And you just get dropped by your country.
Oh, look, what did Don Bradman say? Leave the game in a better place than when you entered that. So,
was the conversation with John Buchanan and Ricky Ponting, team balance, when you got dropped?
I can't recall. I just thought No, McGrath came back. That's what it was.
So that gives me to my next question. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we know you're a bit of a prankster in your day in the Australian team. How did you actually get the soccer or rugby ball in the line of McGrath running in so that he would do his ankle and get yourself into the team?
I actually had nothing to do with that at all.
Liar.
And no. And the reason why was that, well, obviously it's Glenn McGrath. You don't want him stepping on it. I was trying to get Binger to step on it. But no. Not the case at all. I'll tell you what, how it worked for me, and the view is really weird because I, in the day, and I don't know when it changed, maybe you can remember, but I, as a 12th man, I had to mark the run-ups of the other bowlers.
Yep.
And I can't work out when that changed. Anyway, you just used to be responsible for your own. Anyway, I'm having to mark out, you know, someone's number with the tape and I've got it all there. And I'm down on, virtually on my knee, you know, doing this. And next thing, I'd glanced to the left and seen McGrath down in a screaming heap. And all of a sudden, I remember John and I think Punter was there at the time. They started laughing at him, thinking, ah, get up, mate, get up. And then you saw him he couldn't. And then all of a sudden, there was just some distress going on over there. But at the right side over here with the England team, where they were warming up, I was watching them and they, all of a sudden, you could sort of see them. They all of a sudden, whoa, what's going on here? Like, and so I had Merv. Merv was the selector on duty with his tour groups. Anyway, he's come over to me. And when that happened, I thought, right, let's see what's going on here. I realised it's happening here because Sean Tate was actually sore or injured or something wasn't quite right. They weren't going to play an extra spinner in McGill. And it was one of those ones just thinking, oh, I'm a chance here. I'm a real chance. Anyway, Merv come up and says to me, he said, oh, Casper, obviously you've seen what's happened with McGrath. He's out. You're right to go. And I looked at Merv and I said, mate, that's bloody lucky, that. He said, what? I said, oh, lucky I got in before 3 a.m. last night. It was just, otherwise it could have been awesome. Not the case. It didn't happen. It was early in bed because you might just get a chance and might just get a chance to play a test match and single-handedly save test cricket.
Exactly. Hey, and what about your decision to force Ricky Ponting, the captain, to bowl first on the flattest pitch ever? Why did you do that?
Yeah. You just want to bowl every time. We bowl first. Then you can sit down and relax and let the batsman do their job. But we all know that never happens.
What was your buy? Did you look at the pitch? And do you remember much chat about it? I mean, generally, you're back first. But
having played a fair bit of county cricket and a few of the guys had, that Edgbaston pitch normally does a bit. It's normally got plenty of bounce, and which is why Edgbaston used to attract Wacko Unis for many years. Alan Donald used to just do that. It was the bounciest track in the UK. There happened to be a mini cyclone ripped through Birmingham a couple of days earlier. And I kid you not, there was actually floods, there was all that.
Yeah.
So we've turned up and thought, right, this will be interesting. The wicket generally bounces, it carries, and we've turned up and looked at it, and it did look grey. It didn't have, you know, it had sort of a good grass, but it just looked a little different. But not
grey doesn't excite me as a fast bowler. Grey's not green wood.
No, we like green. Green's my favourite colour. Yeah. Anyway, and really out of that decision, it was incredible, wasn't it? Whereby I think it was there was almost a mantra of Australian captains where no one, yeah, you know, like you bring the toss and bowl. Win the toss and bat every single time from there.
No, well, I was with a tour group with Merv. He was doubling up chairman selectors and chairman of thing, and that first 2 hours was nuts, wasn't it? Like, it was just aggressive fields like you do, and it just didn't do anything. But fast forwarding, so you walk out, 62 runs needed. You're in pretty good form. I mean, you're coming out on a king pair.
That wasn't the case.
You made a first ball duck in the first innings.
What do you mean, a king pair?
Well, a king pair is when you make two golden ducks.
Don't know. I've never heard that before.
Oh, ever. Okay.
I only played for 20 years, but yeah, but that's fine. Yep.
So you obviously weren't thinking about that, but
no, I wasn't.
You know, as soon as you get out there, what do you think? You and Binger would be probably pretty relaxed, wouldn't you? You're just thinking, well, we'll let it go. We're behind the eight ball here against let's be honest, a very, very good English attack.
It was incredible. What happened going out with Binger and the noise? the crowd were right in anyway. I went up to Bing and sort of smiled at him and said, right, mate, well, you know, we just got to keep, obviously, the heads and nose and toes, I suppose, was what they were looking to do and try and get us out every single ball. And one of the things I remember saying to Binger, and we said, just let's have some fun, mate. Just, you know, see how we go and how deep we can get this and just have fun. And it was incredible because they were. Every ball was either the nose or the toes. And we were scoring. We've been scoring at 4 or 5 runs and over. not so through blazing cover drives or hook shots. Well, I'll tell you what happened. Well, the whole way through, I think there was a short ball from, I don't know, it might have been Flintoff, and I sort of leant back and gave a bit of a cut, you know, feeling quite comfortable with that sort. Simon Jones ran in from third man and spilt it. Bang. So we thought, oh, right, maybe that's it. Maybe we're away here. And it was incredible because we were just scoring runs. The runs were coming, and then all of a sudden, I just remember, it's really distinct, this, when Flintoff was bowling and he's bowled to Binger. I was at the non-strikers end. He's bowled to Binger and it's hit the foot marks down the leg side. And Geraint Jones didn't have a chance because then it just pinged off and for 4 byes. It went from 13 runs to single figures, 9. And then all of a sudden, from all the crowd, the noise, it just went silent. Because I think right then everyone realised, holy shit, that maybe Australia's a chance here. And even then, the whole way through, every over or in between balls, we'd sort of walk down, have a smile at each other, and just keep loving it, just keep having fun here, and shit, we don't know where we can get to.
Yeah, and, I mean, I was in the crowd, and it was sort of like, oh, my God, we're going to beat the Aussies. And then it was just this gradual change to, oh, we can't lose it from here. Yeah. So it was amazing atmosphere, but, you know, just to see the, you know, what we love so much about Test match cricket. And the actual ball you talked about, and what about the shot again? I just replayed it. I mean, it almost looked like you'd gone the Dilshan scoop before there was a Dilshan. It was almost the cat. It could have been the Casper scoop. That could have been you.
I could have been, absolutely, and I think it would have been a hit. Certainly, it's what Rebel Sport. Do you sell a bat or the? Or a glove. Maybe we need glove shaped to different.
Once again, you're almost there. That could have been, you know, all the T20 players now. We go, oh, Casper, you know, handy number 11, high score of just 25 in Test match cricket. But he had the 360 degrees. He had the Casper scoop.
I would actually, you're right. It could have been good. But I think it was a wonderful example of just those fine, how fine those moments are from obviously good days, great days, or just the days that don't work. And even that whole series, to be honest, to have the Australian team, I think it was even a tee on the last day of the 5th test, it was still in the balance. There was a chance that we still could do it. And it was like double extra time. And that's why it was the greatest series, because it just dragged it out. The moments throughout the whole, every test match, was just extraordinary.
It was like 100 miles an hour, the whole series, wasn't it? Like, it was just insane. Yeah. What about the iconic moment that you also missed out at? You know, Freddie goes to Binger, but where were you? You should have gone in there, ran past Binger and shook, because Freddie's so famous. I mean, it could have been you in that iconic team, you know, sportsmanship moment.
The thing was, I think I had people come to me and said, oh, you know, that photo, you know, what did Andrew Flintoff say to you? You know, and I said, I was down the other end and no one gave a shit about me. I think Freddie might have been saying, suck shit, mate. That's we won all. I don't know what he said.
But it's the perception. You've always talked about it. It's the perception.
I have, absolutely. And even, I'll tell you one little takeaway from that whole series, and maybe the lens I've always seen the Australian cricket team has been really unique. So 10 years, I was in that team and spent time in, but also out. 13 times, I'm pretty sure I was told once that I was actually dropped from the team. I actually find my way back in. But one of the things I saw is my unique view I had of the team was the people and the way the behaviours or what they spoke about and expectations, and it really, it's a bit like your own kids. You go away for a week when they're really young, you come home and then things change, you know, so there's new words or new things they're doing.
Yeah.
And so coming in and out of that team with all the individuals that we all know so well and the environment, but I reckon that Ashes series was the one time in that 10-year period when in that dressing room the word luck was used. And the reason why I'm framing it like that is that the only team that talks about luck is the loser, because you need luck. Winners never, celebrate, how lucky were we? And everyone, and that really we were, because there was, bad decisions, or, Simon Kadish getting LBW with pitching that far down leg, or there's, drop catches, great catches, injuries to gun players, all those things that sort of you feel like when you're losing are conspiring against you. But when you're winning, you're on.
Yeah, it was interesting. Someone around the party there, I think it was their first trip, I remember him saying it was interesting how a great team can still lose confidence quite quickly. Still such a and then the language changes, as you said. We're going to get better, or we'll change. We're just having bad luck. Body language is such a strong thing as well. So
You know what else was really different about that one trip was because there was maybe it was the first time where we had sort of families come and stay, because all the time away, with accommodation. I remember Gilly, Adam Gilchrist, his family had stayed, needed a bit more room in another apartment away from the hotel and the team hotel. But what was kind of really weird was that it became like a workplace, in that you'd go to work in the morning, you catch the bus, have breakfast with your family in the hotel, and sure, it's not every day you're doing a buffet. But you end up going to work, getting on the bus, going to work with your colleagues. But at the end of the day, you'd actually get on the bus, you'd come back to the hotel, and we were almost encouraged. There was sort of a feeling like we should, spend a bit less time together, like sort of just spend time with family. Yeah. And what was weird about it was that there was a little bit of some bickering on some parts, the partners, and as people were sort of like treading a bit carefully, it was just a bit distant. And the one thing in hindsight, and certainly, even then at the time, thought, no, because they're under pressure, you've got to pull in close. That's when you just needed everyone just to really pull in tight and be really close and like I said, together and battle your way out. So that was in professionalism, I suppose, and the journey we've all had. It was something that was just a different stage. And I guess it's gone a whole other level now.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, coming into the team now, you've that's all you know is your family around, and they're away so long. So good luck to them. Hey, Casper, one of the reasons I got you on today, you're chairman of Sports Corp. You've got an exciting SmartBall launching. Can you tell us about, your involvement there and going forward with this ball?
Yeah, it's look, in my 20 years as a player and 10 in administration in cricket, it's the coolest bit of sport tech, I would say. And the reason being that it actually gives you feedback, gives the player feedback. So instead of it being, a device or capturing data for the trainer or the umpires or even the broadcast, this is for the player because it's getting feedback. So what we've been able to do with Kookaburra. So
just quickly, you're going.
Yeah, with Kookaburra, what we've done is we've actually partnered with them and developed a smart cricket ball, replaced the cork rubber compound that sits inside the ball that the ball's built around. And in the Kookaburra turf ball at this stage, which is the best ball, we've got an accelerometer, a magnetometer, there's a battery inside the case that we've developed and all the testing we've done through the University of Queensland, which was the protocol that Cricket Australia put in place of just absolutely belting this ball and to try and break it. And we haven't. So it's been a classic startup story. Great taking a concept to a product and then into the consumer stage right now. So I'm really enjoying it. It's been 3 years. It's been a hell of a journey. And
through COVID as well.
Well, that's where the hell of a journey really took over, because when you're trying to raise money for the business to save it. Managed to find a UK company called Velocity Capital. The guys there are fabulous, awesome to deal with. And we've actually done really well getting through last year and start of this year, to the point where we're actually going to be at the Caribbean Premier League. And the ball's going to be used in the broadcast. So August 26 this year, it's in the CPL. It's actually, we've also getting the ball used for the Brisbane Premier League, which is the amateur league up here in Brisbane. It starts on Sunday. I know that KO is broadcasting two of their matches on the Sunday, back after each other, and streamed through by Frogbox, Interact Sport, and MyCricket as well. So it's really exciting. The way I sort of frame what we do, and the reason why, our purpose, if you like, is we want to empower the athlete. We want to engage the players, all players at all levels, but also and mainly is excite the fans, because they're going to see stuff, you know, from the fan level. They're going to see stuff they've never seen before. What we pick up is the speed out of the hand, speed pre-bounce, and also speed post-bounce. Those three markers, the revolutions of the ball out of the hand, and revolutions post-bounce. But what is, I reckon, the coolest one under the radar at the moment is power. So power of the ball out of the hand. So on release, how many watts is the ball coming out at?
And so what does that translate to? Are you trying to work out, you know, potentially, you know, that's someone who bowls a heavy ball, or they're the quicker ones? Or
Well, no, well, speed, you've got obviously the radar gun for speed, and you've got the deceleration, I suppose. But for me, one of the things was giving some context to all these fabulous terms in cricket.
Yeah.
You know, the heavy ball is precisely it. And so now we can actually put you know, a metric around it. You know, so here's the data that says that, you know, Riley Meredith bowled, you know, that ball at 53, you know, watts, you know, out of the hand.
It's also interesting, you know, like even from boy, young boys and girls up to the elite level, they all want to know how quick they bowl. So I'm assuming this will be as accurate as anything. And consistency, because, you know, working, being a commentator, you know, you commentate in some competitions and you go, nah, the radar gun is a lot quicker in this competition there. for spinners who don't spin the ball, you know, is it because they've got low revs? And even, you know, our old pastime, swing bowling, you know, we talk about that coming down the back of the ball is really important as opposed to pushing it out. You know, we might start to get some feedback on, because they're the two arts that I think we're probably lacking a bit in Australia is a group of spin bowlers and swing bowlers, and maybe this ball might help us unearth a few.
Yeah, I think that's what's the most exciting part about it, is that for the first time we're able to pick up new data. And when I say data, I suppose for a player, for an athlete, an elite level, you've got a coach telling you that looks good and telling you how to do it. You've also got video. You can watch that. But the part, I think, for us as players, and it's hard to describe this to anyone who hasn't done it, but it's feel. It's all about feel. And so when you've got these different sources of being able to see it on video, then you've got the coach telling you, but at the same time, you have some data to back up the feel that you got with the ball coming out. To me, that's the most exciting part. And as you pointed out, I think that's fine at the elite level. And what we're trying to do is get the elite guys using it, and being Kookaburra, the balls are used certainly in Australia, but also every white ball competition around the world, IPL, ICC events, it's all the Kookaburra turf white white turf ball. But more importantly, I think then it's if it's in the broadcast, because they're getting better, they're improving, we're loving that, the sports science loves that. If they're using it, then it's actually selling the message to every single player. So my big goal and dream for this business is to make it affordable, but most of all, accessible to every single player. So
what a catchphrase.
You like it?
I like it.
Should be in marketing, but no. But this is the whole thing. It's all about that accessibility, because as you point out, it doesn't matter how old you are, you want to see how fast you're bowling. And if all of a sudden, you know, buying a $250, you know, $500 radar, that's not going to happen to any club cricket or junior cricket. Buying even the Revolutions to see that out of a $50,000, you know, TrackMan machine isn't going to do that either. So that's the beauty of it. And more importantly, it's about seeing what you've done when getting that feedback, even for my 14-year-old son. But more importantly, it's about comparing yourself with your mates, your family, your friends, and even, I think, for as far as talent recognition, one of the things we can do, we can actually identify where the balls are around the planet and, say, the revolution. So one of the things I'm really excited about doing is this ball being in India, getting to tier not 1 and 2 and 8, 10, 15 cities, but out to the tier 50 cities.
Yeah.
And you're going to find some wonderful stories. It's going to be an opportunity to change some people's lives. I really do feel that.
It sounds exciting, and good luck with that. We'll be keeping in touch with the progression.
Good catch by Michael Kasperovic. Ball was hit pretty firmly. Might have just been the change of pace. Every now and again, he rolls the
Kasper, back the to your career to a degree. I've got a few little questions here, but it's a tough one off the top of your head. But can you describe your career and mainly your bowling in your stages from 17 to 35?
Yep.
Development and
I think we learn by doing is the sort of the theme overall. And I know when you're young, you steam in, bowl quick because you can. You swing the ball because you can. And one of the things that I had, I was even told, I think at one stage early on by Trevor Owens when he dropped me, I think it must have been the second or third time. he said, "Kasper, we see you as a wicket taker, but you go for runs." And I hadn't been in the one-day team. So I made it my sort of like goal for the next two seasons in domestic cricket. I think it was the FAI Cup back then, or it might have been
Mutual.
Well, it could have been one of those. Anyway, I remembered for 2 years, I made damn sure that I didn't go over 50 once in 2 years. And you're opening the bowling, you're bowling first over and you're bowling last over. And so then I could go back to him and say, "Listen, this is how it works." Of which straight away, and if you use the word perception, he said, "Oh, actually, right." And then surprise, surprise, I think in the next one-day series, they end up started picking me again. what I might have just forgotten to tell him was a couple of those innings I might have bowled six overs for about 48. But he didn't need to know.
It's all about.
He didn't need to know that, did he? No, exactly.
What about like your stock ball as a teenager compared to just your last stage with the Australian team? Because I thought you evolved and adapted. Fast out swingers. Then near the end, you made yourself really adaptable. That off cutter seamer reverse swing played a big part. So you make that change?
Well, I think, as I said, learn by doing. And I reckon the biggest change for me was being out of the Australian cricket team. So not being picked and I'm out, I'm in, I'm trying to, and at times you try too hard. And it's just natural. You go, "I'm only going to try." And it was a game against South Australia. I remember this because I got dropped. It was actually just after my test debut, actually. Yeah, test debut. So it was the first time I was dropped. We played and I didn't get a wicket the first test. I didn't get a wicket the second test in Sydney. And then we're playing New South Wales, Queensland, New South Wales. And it was virtually a bowl-off, if you like, full strength at the Gabba. I remember Mark Taylor was there and Aussie captain, all that sort of stuff. I'm like, "Shit, I'm going to get stuck into you." And that's how we're going to do it. And that innings, I went out and because they were talking about Bic had been getting wickets for Queensland and I'm sort of, I'm in the team not getting wickets. So I remember coming in and there was, the nick that just fell short of the slips or the LBW that, wasn't out. And then it was like, but all of a sudden Bic was getting a few. And I just found myself trying so hard. And anyway, sure enough, I end up at the end of the game. Look, unfortunately, I haven't picked you. We've gone with Bic. Said, "Okay, great. No, good luck." So I just remember that next game, we went down to South Australia and probably had a week or two to sort of get my head around all that. And I thought, what was I thinking? How was my mind before I played cricket for Australia? What was I thinking about? How did I do this? And getting 50 wickets a year in Shield cricket, doing that a few times. But what was I actually thinking? And the fact of the matter is I was just out there having fun.
Yeah.
I was just out there, relaxed, having fun, and it was happening. And then it was a moment. That was one of my first moments in my bowling career where I just thought, you know what, I'm just going to go and have fun. And I think that really set me up for all those other times where I'm in the team, out of the team. Because you know what, if this is the last time in the Australian team, and I'm not going to be the best player compared with who we got, but I've been given an opportunity. If this is the last time I'm here, I'm going to have that much fun.
That's a great philosophy too. And do you think in our time, and obviously before us, you know, without fast bowling coaches, you actually had to self-coach, self-monitor. And I reckon that's where I got into trouble. You know, you pride yourself on being self-motivational and, you know, a good team player. But I found it, you know, if I was dropping a few percent, it's hard to self-monitor.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it's 10% and you're in a bit of a slump. So, you know, were you able to self-monitor when you were starting to try too hard again and then to reinforce, no, I'm playing because it's fun?
I got good at that because what I'd do, you just find yourself firing up too much and getting frustrated. And that was, to me, that was the key. That was the sign going, okay, just chill it out now. And even games where I tried to fire up, you know, thinking I'm going to be a fiery, fast bowler, to the point where I was, you know, accused. Sometimes people would say, oh, Casper, you're too nice to be a fast bowler.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, I'm still got a stare. We're still walking down the wicket and getting in the batsman's face, but I don't need to sniff and snarl and do all that sort of stuff to get it because I knew that just threw me just a little bit out. And I've had actually some coaches, even Wade Seckham in Queensland, you know, with a couple of bowlers, he'd said, I should go and speak to Casper. And talking to them about that, you know, instead of just trying to be something you're not, or finding, I think that's what I said, learn how it works for you was the key. Because for me, it wasn't about, you know, running in a million miles an hour and bowling as fast as you could. It was all about keeping everything controlled. And ultimately, that's why I use the term just having fun. And I think the journey, I'm sure that every single person that's gone through it, you find your own word or way to do that. And the word for me, it was fun. I don't know. What did you use, Len? What was there?
I reckon my consistency was I used to get in trouble if I was getting too anxious about what's going to happen in the future or too angry backwards. Although you know that I did get quite angry at myself. I just thought that was a better zone to be in than just going through the motions. So I often, you know, tried to get myself going. So a bit better there. But my mantra was win the next ball.
Yep. Yep.
When I was at my best, I just tried to win the next ball.
Yeah.
So that kept me in the now, and I'd plan what I was going to do. And probably when I win the ball, keep a tally. Because once you win one ball, two balls, three balls, four balls, how do you think you're going?
Yeah.
You're going well. And so at its simplest, that's what got me back on track.
And that was the best part, I guess, about being a bowler is when you keep it simple like that because you – we had a good union back in the day to bring it from eight balls and over down to six. Because you got to rest after six. It's like, hang on, I just, you know, I need a break.
I think Rodney Hogg had a lot to do with that. He had two for none off two overs at the Adelaide Oval and walked off. Went to throw the ball to him and he wasn't
All right. Well, maybe that's what he's celebrating.
He said asthma and also asthma. He's an only child.
Didn't he pop another line out to Kim Hughes once? I think Carl Rackman tells a story in the Rebel Tour where he went off the field and Kim Hughes sent someone off and said, go and find him. Where's Rodney Hogg?
Where's Hogg?
Yeah. And what was the line? Something like, tell Kim Hughes that Rodney Hogg's dead.
No, Rodney Hogg's passed away.
He's passed away.
So Big Mocker had to run that out. Hey, mate, just some quick other ones about your career. Best captain?
I really enjoyed Steve Waugh. And the reason being that he was supportive. It's kind of nice when you're feeling, you know, really supportive and captain sort of backing you. It's through that, you know, through a period of time, it correlates to sort of, I guess, performance as well. And really, I think I try to explain this to someone once before around the Australian captains. It's sort of... I suppose when Alan Border was captain, the best way I put it is Alan Border captain, he was the icon to a younger group of players when he captained. Then you had Mark Taylor come in, who was a peer of his group So he was leading and sort of had all the resources of people around and mates and all that sort of stuff. So when Steve Waugh became the captain, he was the icon to us, you know, younger group as well. When Ricky Ponting came in, he was the captain to a peer group of all blokes and went to the academy with him in 94 years. But then everyone left. And then he, his process then, he had to become the icon. He became automatically icon to a group of players. And then when he left, you know, Michael Clark was that peer again. And then, you know, I suppose he was sort of, you know, finding the way that he did it. But for me, under Steve Waugh, I really enjoyed that. But I've got to say my favourite captain, Adam Gilchrist. It was India 2004 when Ricky, I think, had a knee injury or something like that, but he was there. But we ended up winning the series over there, the first time for 1,000 years. And even that, coming back to your earlier question about whether the changes in your bowling, in the cricket, in the bowling context here, I really changed the way I bowled. Instead of bowling outswing and that sort of, I went over, must have been about the 12th time I was dropped from the Australian team. I went to Glamorgan. I played cricket over in Glamorgan, so down in Sapphire Gardens. And it's not generally a fast bowler's first pick, no. But I'd never had first choice of ends or anything like that. So I went down there and, you know, it was a low, slow wicket. And it always had been. The rest, and having played for other counties, you'd go down there and it was always grim. Jesus, grim down there in Cardiff. Anyhow, I'm down there and I'm going to have fun. That was my whole mantra, have fun. But one of the things I did after trying to bowl outswingers and getting fat outside edges that had run down a third man, they'd never carry through the slips when the ball going away. So I thought on a slow, low wicket, low shit wicket, I'm just going to hit deck hard and we're going to get the ball coming back into off stump, straightening up and going back in, setting a field, so putting a man, two men back, so maybe even a man forward a square leg on the fence, maybe a mid wicket as well, short mid wicket, catching if they decide to flick off their, you know, off their legs. But you're not going any straighter than middle stump. But everything's really tight in that line. So I did that a couple of years and had a lot of success. You know, I think, you know, not only did, you know, 70 or 80 wickets in the competition, I actually won the Weatherall Award for the all-rounder of the first division cricket, second division cricket, the all-rounder of the year.
How?
To go with, well, generally all-rounders, it's both wickets and runs. So I end up scoring, I think it was about 800 runs with the bat. Yeah. Don't look so surprised, mate.
You got a highest test score of 25. How did
97 first class? 97 first. Oh, 93 first class. Sorry, for
Australia.
Division
two, was it? Or I like the wickets. But sorry, taking the mickey there.
Yeah.
So a lot of the questions, sorry, keep going, you know, that I asked on social media where it was about this 04 tour. So finish off. Yeah.
So one of the things, it was actually on the plane on the way over to India. Now, not that I was with Jason Gillespie, not that we were taking on any drinking records to India or anything like that. What did you get? What was your record? You'd be close to the record holder there, wouldn't you?
I think I missed out by 50. From Booney. We weren't allowed, were we? They'd stop that.
Yeah. Is that because there's no champagne for the bowlers down the back of the bus? Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard back in economy, isn't it?
I know.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so one of the things, having seen, I guess, and developed these skills, were obviously reverse swing after India the first time. Well, I went there in 1998, and I'll come back to that. I think I'll come back after this. But when we turned up in India in 2004, it was the third time we'd gone there. We hadn't won a series. We came close, but we were doing what Australian teams had done so well. Bowled short of a length, outside of stump, and build pressure. And the execution of that plan is what has held Australians so well for so long and had the skill of it. So one of the things I just used with Dizzy, I said, I reckon we do this differently. I reckon we play at their strength. We go straighter in line, but we set fields accordingly because that man who's deep backward square or deep forward square even on the slow wickets, having two men back, we can bang the pitch and force them on the back foot, looking for the hook shot on the back foot. to try and catch them on the crease, the ball that doesn't quite bounce or hits them, you know, on that off stump for an LBW. If they do get behind it and flick it, then we've got one short mid wicket to catch it. Yeah. If they get it past him, they're only one running one run. Instead of a boundary, it's one run. You're going
to
make them
run.
So
this is a total different line to the couple of tours we went on.
Absolutely.
Outside off stump. Total
Absolutely.
Different line. And the important thing is, I think, the discipline and skill that you guys showed, patience, but the field placement, that mid-wicket, that player, you know, and, you know, with that mid-wicket in with two out, how many times did they try and hit it finer?
Lakshman, Oh, absolutely. And even like Lakshman got out there because that's what he does. And even when he came out, he put two catches at mid-wicket.
Yeah.
And just prey on his head because instinct means he's going to flick it. And even if he does, he gets one run. Even out of that whole tournament, what was the great result was that Rahul Dravid didn't score a run. And he was bowled to LBW most times because what we did, you bowl straight a line to him and he'd leave cover, a little bit of a gap at cover. So all of a sudden he's trying to hit you through cover on a straight line with sort of half a bat. So just little things like that was really designed and to mess with their head a bit because it wasn't how they played. And really that's the whole key when you're playing in India, when you're playing anywhere. For any bowler, the premise for 10-19 test cricket, but everywhere you play, it's about adjusting your skills to suit those conditions and the situation of the game. That's the art of bowling. Plain and simple. And that's what we did. The execution was incredible. Obviously, having, you know, with McGrath doing McGrath was awesome, and Dizzy was spectacular. And the fact that Brett Lee, wasn't in the in the team, didn't make it.
And Warnie did a good job too. You know, like he didn't get massive wickets, but he built the pressure. It was probably his best tour to India as well.
Yeah. And it was. And I think it was because, that's their country. That's they play in their conditions. So even Warnie in India, you know, didn't have the impact he had anywhere else in the world because of just they could do that well. So even 1998, the first experience of India was the other turning point in my career. Obviously, just having fun, getting chosen when everyone happened inconveniently, I guess, to be injured. I think you weren't injured, but I know Pistol was, Dizzy was.
Yeah.
McGrath was.
Myself
and Pistol. So Paul Rifle was selected, and Paul Wilson and Adam Dale were the four quicks to play. We had Gav Robertson, Stuart McGill, and
Warnie.
And Warnie, yeah. So three spinners, and that's how we're going to do it. And that was it. You're playing against a Tendulkar, and he was just unbelievable, wasn't he? Because I know you came over for the one days, didn't you?
Yeah, got there for the third test.
You were there for the third test?
Yeah. I was going to play.
That's what I thought.
And then I was really crook. And then you took your fifer, and then we won the final. You know, we had some great games, won the one-day final, yeah.
You know, the funniest thing out of that was that the lesson I learned was when we, at the end of it, so they beat us, and Javagal Srinath, who was there, obviously, gun bowler, senior bowler, I spoke to him before the game. I said, "Hey, Javagal, how are you going?" Just, you know, and the respect thing, as we do, bowlers, respect. They already won the series. Anyway, I just said to him, I said, "Oh, mate, tell us about reverse swing. How's it work?" And he said, "You have to keep the rough side of the ball bone dry." And straight away it was like, because you bowl the ball, keeper gets it, throws it to the slip if you had one, to gully, to point, to cover, back to mid-off. Meanwhile, it's 40 degrees, you've got everyone sweating it up, the ball's being soaked on its way back, and you're having to bowl with this ball and it's doing nothing. So straight away I went back and said to the guys, this is what we have to do. Mucked around at training with it, but even at the game. So you'd end up, even I remember walking over to mid-off and getting the ball with two fingers and getting the ball off with two fingers so we didn't get it wet.
Because the thing is, you would sweat in an igloo. So we don't want you and we don't want your – but we were really inconsistent with our plans in the Aussie team because, remember, we went through – we thought it was weighting. So you actually put heaps of moisture into it. So, you know, we were behind the game, weren't we, in regards to reverse swing?
That was, but Imran Khan went, I believe, in the late 90s when he played for New South Wales, came and introduced the spit rock, they used to call it back in the day. It was just waiting, weight on the shiny side, real waiting, and that was the heavy. But it's not that at all. It's actually air pressure on the rough is how it works. But the outcome out of that day, my big takeaway was the day before the game. Right, day before the game, and Sachin scored so many runs, 100 every innings, and it was just on fire. And it was hot. I had lost about 8.5 kilos of body weight, which means I can't wait till this COVID lifts so I can get back there. Anyway, all of a sudden we're training the day or 2 days before the game, and around the boundary, all of a sudden it was like an oasis, wasn't it? It was all of a sudden it's Dennis Lilly. The greatest fast bowling resource of all time is there. He's at Chinnaswamy Stadium in Bangalore.
He's going to solve all the problems.
So I went to him, Flem. I actually said, the classic thing, I went up and said, "How you going, mate?" And the first thing he said was, he goes, "Oh, how hot is it?" And it's like, "Yeah, it's pretty hot here." So the next thing he says, "Oh, how flat are the wickets?" Must point out that Dennis Lilly never played a test match in India.
Right.
But then I thought, here's the opportunity. Got to use him. There's a resource he is. I said, "Dennis, is there anything? Have you seen Tendulkar or watched his technique? Is there anything you've spotted there that you think that we should actually go for? Can you help me out? Have you got anything for me?" He looks at me. He looks skyward, rubs his beard, comes back and says, "Nah, mate, just make sure you walk off with pride."
I reckon he said two other words in there, and that
there might have been, but maybe not for G-rated or what are we?
No, I reckon his first response was he pondered. So we're going to get gold here, and he goes, "Good luck."
Yeah, yeah, that was.
I reckon, good luck, and then he said that last bit, and we're just going, "Oh my god,
how are we going?" Yeah. So if the greatest follow all time doesn't have an answer, but the thing was, my other takeaway from that, I can't remember if you remember, Flem. Said to him, said, "What about Viv? How'd you, attack Viv?" He said, "How do you contain Viv?" He said, "You can't." He said, "You just got to attack him and hope it's your day."
I remember that. You know, we were looking for some answers, and in hindsight, it was a great answer. As in, yeah, you've got to find your own methods. It's about that. Hey, mate, just about teammates. Did you have someone, an underrated teammate, the highest maintenance teammate, and the most enjoyable or funniest teammate?
I'd spent my whole career, and his my best mate is Andy Bickle.
Yeah.
And the irony is I actually was competing with him the whole time.
Yes.
So when Bick moved down to Brisbane from Laidley, which is about an hour and a half west of Brisbane, he's moved down here with his Bickle Prickle shaved head with a little tuft and, he didn't have any tattoos. Bick's never had tattoos. He looks, strikes, he'd come across back in the day, his nickname was Mad Dog.
Yeah.
Everyone would call him Mad Dog because he'd do his circle work at the top of his mark and steam in and snarl and do all that. Anyway, he came down and it's the irony is that, so he came and lived with me. So at the time, I actually introduced him to my wife, Lindsay, actually introduced him to his wife. I was... We're best men at each other's weddings. He actually lives about 100 metres down the street, would you believe, from where I live now. So, and it makes no sense for a lot of people, I think, and certainly no batsman would understand this, that I reckon our relationship was what helped us out to get the best out of each other the whole way through. Because when I was in the team and not getting wickets, he was playing shield cricket, getting wickets, and then I'd get dropped and he'd come in. And then when he wasn't playing and not getting wickets, I'd be getting wickets to Queensland and then I'd come in. And over that whole time, and I think there's that great fear, that thing with fast bowlers. Certainly was with us, I think, is that, respect is that, this is not easy. This is not easy what we're doing and, you're supporting each other. So, I'd say that. The other one too, I think the other, and it's going to keep it to a bowler theme here, is McGrath. This Glenn McGrath was just, for me, just an absolute hero. And to be able to play and be a mate with someone you sort of admire so much and for everything you've done, it's just, it's we're the luckiest people to do. Not only just live our dream with get a baggy green, but also the people we've actually been able to knock around with.
And I suppose and the Pidge, you know, he was the Terminator because of all the great players we played with, for me, he's the greatest.
Yeah.
Not saying he had the most spectacular game, like a Warne leg spinner, Gillies hundreds at a strike rate or great catches, Ponting number three, winning, setting up series in the first couple. But he had no natural predator, McGrath. He was the predator. His record at home and away on all different grounds, the average is about the same, low 20s, whereas all those three other guys, Steve Waugh and Mark Waugh, you know, there was countries where they struggled against, but not McGrath.
No, and that's the thing. The difference between his good day and his bad day was nothing. You know, you wouldn't know. The way that I think that makes him just such an incredible person was the fact that, well, for lots of reasons. First of all, the fact he came was, when I say identified, he played a game of cricket up in a country cup game in New South Wales, northwestern New South Wales somewhere.
Yeah.
And someone up there, was it Brad McNamara or someone said,
I think it was Doug Walters, Dougie.
It was Doug. It's okay. Well, Doug said, come on down to Sydney, play great cricket. Sutherland, they'll give you accommodation. So he's come down off his own back, you know, not country kid. I'm going to say not many life skills, maybe, in city life skills. Sorry, city life skills is probably a better way to put it.
I still question that to this day.
So I think that's for him to go down and be living in a caravan on his own and play club cricket and just was extraordinary. So, and just his journey. But the fact of the matter is,
great story.
You know, well, even just with Jane, right? Jane McGrath, and living with that. For the two of them, the fact that she beat cancer twice, you know, and went through everything there and all that hardship. I'll give you a good example. Every single time you'd see McGrath, he's, how you going, mate? Just out of manners. And his response every single time was, never better, mate.
Yep.
Never better. Even to the point the day after he stepped on that ball, day one, Edgbaston Test Match 2005, he's turned up the next day. He's walked in with a big black moon boot, right?
Yeah.
He's walked in with crutches and all that. And oh, shit, mate, how are you going? Never better, mate. I've never felt better.
Did you feel guilty, putting that ball in his path, though?
You still haven't answered it. And you were on the tour group, weren't you? So maybe there's something a lot evil, more evil. Were you the Fanatics or something like that? Or I don't know.
No, he was the last. He would have been the last player I wanted out. I wanted to find Lords exactly. For me as a spectator, that win there was one of the great sporting experiences as a fan. Yeah.
But and that's the thing with McGrath is that he just leaves positivity at all stages. As much as he loses his rag in the in the dressing room, but things didn't work out for him. But it was just
mainly with his batting. That was the thing, wasn't it? He took it so seriously. Hey, talk about positivity. What about worst teammate to be running the rock box, playing the music in the rooms?
Look, it's take your pick for a top six batsman in any team, generally. Michael Slater at least had an element of a sort of a Bon Jovi. At least there was some sort of like guitar,
Green Day,
heavy guitar. He didn't mind that. Slats was pretty good like that, but he did control that rock box. You just had to really keep an eye out for, say, a Justin Langer or more, even worse, Matthew Hayden.
No.
I think because Matthew Hayden had put on all sorts of things. Like there was Graham Connors, who was a country singer. Cyclone Season was a big one he used to love.
Now there's one. Well, Langer, Justin, he loved that Jesse song.
Yeah.
You know, talk about a lost girlfriend and a lost cat. It's Joshua Catterson, wasn't it? Jesse. Worst song I've ever heard.
Lost identity, I reckon, is what it was.
And Haydos had just listened to that 1970s country music. We've just won a test match.
Yeah, exactly. Look, I didn't mind getting into country occasionally, mate. And I think with John Williamson.
Steve Waugh.
You'd respect that. He was, you know, whatever he wanted, we got it. But I just remember even the rock box was a classic. When I first made the Queensland team, must have been the second year or so, it was 1991. 1991. The reason why I know that is that this is the 30th year anniversary of Pearl Jam.
Boom.
10. The first CD. 30th anniversary. So I'd actually heard Alive the first time and I thought, this is the greatest song I've ever heard. And then there was, I think I even splashed out, Lash didn't get cassette, but I actually got it on CD.
That's cutting edge in 91.
I was earning big bucks in our match payments back then too. I was living at home, mind you.
But the CDs were actually $29.99, which was quite expensive. And LP was $9.99.
Well, I saved money. Like I said, I was living at home still, and so for house and board. So what the thing was, I actually thought I built up the courage. Young bloke, you know, the rock box, someone kind of left it unattended, a bit like a gap in on a football field. You sort of see a half a gap and I'm going to take it. I'm going. I'm in. So I put it down there. I put Alive on there. I'm just hoping, you know, you want to sort of like really get, you know, connect to people in the team and show some initiative and all that. And all of a sudden, Alive's coming on. Da-da-da-da-da. Anyway, all of a sudden, I had Carl Rackerman just get up, walk over to it, and he said, "This is not music. It is to be called music. It needs a rhythm and a beat. This is neither." And then just stop. So the best part about that rock box, Flem, and I think I did contribute to your book, actually, Biology.
You did.
I did, and that's the way I recalled at the time was that out of all those boy bands that we used to get, you know, the NSYNCs and who else they were. Backstreet Boys, Joshua Katterson, and even Bon Jovi for that matter, where the hell are they now?
Yes.
Pearl Jam. Who else? We've got...
ACDC.
They're all our guys are still rocking and
Foo
still...
Fighters.
And, you know, the best part about it, just like a fast bowler, they're adapting their skills and adjusting their skills to suit the conditions.
Yes. Yeah.
Have you heard that last Pearl Jam CD? It's awesome.
No, it's all good. And this is what I think the fast bowling cartel, you know, you've given a lot of insights for young fast bowlers here today. But one is listen to hard rock.
My son Ed Kasparovic, he's 14. He's a fast bowler. He comes in, bowls quick naturally. He gets that from me, but the best part is he actually gets the aggression from his mother. So he's got all the tools. So so when he was 12 years old, the Foo Fighters were playing here in Brisbane at Suncorp Stadium. I managed to get hold of some tickets. And I thought, as a learning experience, be a good father bonding experience with his son, took him to the Foo Fighters concert, and he was singing along with Dave Grohl and loving it. So that's good parenting, isn't it?
It's almost first-class cricket there. I mean, we could get into the Kiss concerts that we've been to and in all regards to that. What about we love lauding the fast bowling cartel. We're members. We're running the cricketing world these days. What about some thoughts on your fast bowling cartel colleagues in the Aussie team and the Queensland Bulls?
Yep. Just before we start, I'm going to put a claim in here.
Oh, geez.
That I'm actually responsible for the term cartel. And the reason being, we were away on a tour and I was during the Australian summer, but we were reading the news and it was always been the fast bowling union.
Yes.
It's always the union. Look after each other in the union and all that sort of stuff. Mike Whitney, in my first season, sat me down and told me with over a six-pack in the dressing room that, you know, the union, and he just told me all about it. So we got to look after each other. Anyway, the union was there, but the union started to just get a little bit frayed around the edges when professionalism come in, perhaps.
Yeah.
Anyway, at the time I was reading, there was a bit of media around Smorgans, I think, or was there was Smorgans is one company, but there was the cardboard box companies, and they were referred to as a cartel. And I thought, well, that's an interesting term because there was two major players and they called it a cartel. And so a bit of research was the cartel controls the market, who enters, who goes. And I thought that is perfect. So I will claim that it was myself, and I dare say with Dizzy, just to shoot it past him and see what he thought. And then to this day, so I'm going to say that I'm all over the cartel for obvious reasons. I think that the thing about the fast bowling cartel, when I first played cricket for Queensland, Jeff Thompson was my coach. Carl Rackham was in the team. I had Craig McDermott when he wasn't in the Australian side. He was there as well. So I had all these iconic fast bowlers, and certainly from a Queensland perspective, even Dirk Taslar was my first roommate.
What a wonderful the old left-arm swinger.
Just an awesome bloke too, and I think that's one of the prerequisites to being part of the fast bowler. There's a good bloke test, and which also is part of the selection criteria. Anyway, and you found that. You found that you had that as a resource, and there was an element of sharing, and helping out each other the whole way through. I'd like to think we maintained that my time in Queensland, to this day it's sort of still happening. But also in the Australian team with the blokes that we played with and had the opportunity too. You spend so much time with guys on, it'd be during matches, on tours, getting to know guys so well. And so you get to know their buttons as well, what to press, what not to. But I think that's it. It's seeing people, and for the good of the team, everyone going well. So that's what existed. And from what I've seen and chatting to the guys today, it's still going strong.
It is. And we still have our catch-ups, don't we? Generally one test match a year. Yep. The president, Glenn McGrath, will make a bit of a speech. He was treasurer.
Special guest.
Doing a good job.
Well. Always have a special guest. I've always managed to get a special guest along too.
Carl Rackerman was going to be hard to beat. Big knocker. They loved his role. But hopefully, COVID safe, we might have the opportunity to do it this year during the Ashes. Well, last Ashes, I think the English fast bowling members, we'd had about 20 beers and they walked in, didn't we?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, we're into that. Right. Hey, mate, what about, we talk about the best grounds you played at. What about worst grounds?
Oh, that's without a doubt. 1998, there was a one-day game. It might have been the first one-day game we played after that test series when Sachin was belting the ball everywhere, scoring hundreds everywhere. And it was Ko Chin down south. Southwest.
Yeah.
But to the point, and I'd lost all that weight earlier on pre-tour. It was the most incredible. It's hot. It was like 40 plus degrees. And I remember before the game saying to walking out there, and we got to know the other players, and Mohammad Azharuddin, the Indian captain, obviously having played three tests against them, and the whole tour that we spent a couple of months, but just to the same to him, I said, mate, this is too hot. This is crazy. What's going on? And he said, we should not be playing. Now, the Indian players, I think, would have warmed up on the ground for what, 15 minutes?
Not even that.
What did Jeff Marsh have us doing?
We did a training session, didn't we?
It was a full training session.
Yeah.
And these are the days before you had sports science and isotonic drinks and all the rest of it. We had water, we had Sprite, we had Coke and Thumbs Up, which is an Indian version of Coke. It's a cola, but we quickly called it Thumbs Down, didn't
we? Thumbs Down. Well, I remember the day before and I'd just caught a bit of a flu. And then I was getting over that, but I just remember I've got unfit all of a sudden, because we trained hard the day before too. But even in the warm-up, remember we're running and the Indian players were sort of walking out, having a sip, little hit and walking off. And we were going, look at them, they're soft. We'll get them today. No, they're not soft. They were smart.
They were smart.
But when did you think you were in trouble? Because you were the first cricketer I ever thought was going to photosynthesize on the field. Like you actually forgot how to run almost, didn't you? Like you just collapsed.
I didn't fall on the ground on the ground, but what happened was that we actually bowled, I think I bowled probably five overs straight. Five overs straight. And then I remember feeling out on the fence and not being able to breathe. I was actually like this, not being able to get any air into lungs. And of course and sort of all starting to get a little bit panicked about this, thinking, I can't breathe. And anyway, I gave it an over, two overs or something like that, trying to just do it. And I remember just going up to Steve Waugh there was a point I sort of jogged up to him. I said, "Oh, Steve, I just got to go if I can't breathe." And he just looked at me. He's gone, get off. And I remember going off the ground, and Errol Alcott has just got me, ripped me clothes, and he just put me in an ice bath and just dunked me in this whole bath, full body in this thing. I was in there for a while, felt like whatever. And then I said, right, I'm good. I went back out on the field.
Yeah, I remember you coming back on. I've gone exactly. Yeah. The big fella's back.
Get me out there. Anyway, I remember getting back out of the field. And then Steve Waugh said, okay, you're right to bowl. I said, yeah, mate, give it to me. You know, I remember bowling three balls. Then all of a sudden, it just kicked in and my head was spinning. I couldn't see. And I thought, the only way I'm going to get through this is a short run. So I ended up, I think I had about, it was probably about, I don't know, maybe like 15, 20 steps to a normal run. I ran off about, I don't know, 7 steps. And I remember trying to muck around and trying to keep the fun happening. I remember with the ball in the hand, but with, I think, my left hand, like a jockey, I was trying to pull out the persuader, the whip.
No, you were doing that. You were doing
that. Trying to pull out the shillelagh and just kick
it on. But we're not in on the joke. We're just going, he's lost it.
I know. But the part of that, there's a couple of things about that. The real takeaways for me were going, and you're sent straight off the field straight away. So I was off, bang, gone.
Yeah.
I remember getting on the bus, and I think Ricky Ponting, is it part of, or Marto might have vomited on the bus, just a big
punter. Yeah.
Yeah, punter on the bus. I remember going back to the hotel room, and I had this awesome roommate. It was actually David Fleming. Going back to the room and in amongst the channel, whatever it was, the Bollywood theme music in the background in the room, I remember lying down in my bed and sort of not being able to move, but then all of a sudden just crying. I was just crying and I just couldn't help it. I said, I don't know what's going on, mate. And you've looked at me and I think you just, did you get Hooter once again, our physio?
Oh, I just said, got on to Hooter. It was like being Billy there, but you were just so disorientated. Like you had no control over yourself. So
I think what I needed was a ham and pineapple pizza and a chocolate milkshake or something like that.
Did
we go one of those that night? No.
But I do remember that we travelled next day, played the next day in 43 degrees. I think you did get a rest, but it was like day and age, you'd be 4 or 5 days off. But
A month.
But I remember Hoot come in and, you know, it was a lot, but I was bloody worried about you. But it was funny how early on it was more about, oh, I've got unfit all of a sudden.
No better place to pass away than playing cricket for Australia. Well, surely there's...
Remembered just so well. But the other thing I remember is... Well, a couple of things. I bowled 7 extras. So not only did I have to bowl 10, I bowled an extra 7. And then in the last over, I looked up, I actually bowled 7 balls. The umpire didn't count them. And I remember getting off, and it was like I jumped in a pool, like I was squelching much. And I just couldn't move. Yeah, you're moaning on the thing. Marto bowled 9 balls and was vomiting in the shower. I can't bat. Steve Waugh's going, you're going to have to bat.
Work and then I reckon you, safety.
did you get Sachin out?
I did get him out for less than 20 runs. I got to look at the game, but that's the irony of that match, isn't it? That he got man of the match in every test match and all that. We managed to get him out for like less than 25.
The great man can have a bad day.
Man of the match, Sachin Tendulkar.
Yeah.
What do you get? Five for 25 or something, bowling leggies and offies, and it's just, yeah.
That was the irony, wasn't it? I reckon you got him out for under 5.
And might have been, like, too.
Well, at least even the great man can have a bad day, bad luck. Yeah, picked up 5 for man of the match. And the other irony I looked up, it was actually on April Fool's Day.
Oh, really?
If that's somebody's joke, Crab.
Oh, wow. That's it. That's not so funny.
Another little bit of a serious one. Do you have, besides walking out on that field that day and coaching, any regrets for your career?
To be honest, no. I think, every single time I got on the field, you gave it absolutely everything. There was nothing left in the tank. I wasn't leaving things to chance. But I guess if there's one thing I would have, I would have loved to have done more than anything on the cricket field, is scored a Test 50. Test 100, of course, but just Test 50, because I think there's a couple of smartasses out there that just
they're not easy
bringing up. Just keep bringing up the facts at every chance they get.
At the fast-filing cartel meeting.
No, that's not an official meeting. Not an official meeting.
You know where you could have got lucky was in 2001 tour. I was central to getting raising the ball, you know, for Pfeiffer. You know,
that got over
the line. And then my next one was if you're batting 9, 10 or 11, if you score 25, you should raise the bat. And
I didn't get
ground swill for that one. Steve Waugh poo-pooed that one. But if I had, you would have been able to raise your bat once.
That's right. And along with my Weatherall All-Rounder of the Year award in county cricket, absolutely. I think my average in first-class cricket is about 17. What's yours?
I don't even worry about it. It was about the baggy green. Average 19. Hey, mate, we've got some questions. First up, on social media, this is from a Lindsay Kasperwich. And the question is it true you won't shave your beard because someone said you look like Bradley Cooper once?
Oh, look. No, that's not true.
It's true because you paused.
No, it's not true because it's been said more than once.
Can you confirm that? How, what, why?
There was a couple of joints, one of places actually. I was once on a plane. There's been, it's happened a couple of times. So,
well, a Stuart Law also said, no, he's Djokovic.
Djokovic. Well, maybe that's it. Maybe whilst Djokovic doesn't grow a beard, I can sort of stand out a bit. I think Djoko looks more like Simon Kadic, actually.
There's a bit of that. There's a bit of that.
Hey,
Crab, been great to catch up. Just final, what's your last sort of advice, particularly for fast bowlers getting into pre-season, and what would you say to them?
I reckon just that piece around having fun, because it's the big thing about being a fast bowler is you got to appreciate pain. It's going to hurt.
Yeah.
There's times. And the part around pain, I'm going to say, is that there's good pain and bad pain. And as a fast bowler, there's going to be days when you get absolute excruciating pain around your body. But it has this remarkable way of disappearing to the point where I actually started calling it and came up with the term the niggle worm. That every single time you bowl, today it might be my left ankle starts hurting, and then all of a sudden you keep bowling and disappears for the next day to appear in my right shoulder. And the thing is, as you get older, that worm ends up the size of a python, I reckon. But I think that's, and I've actually expressed that a couple of times to some young fast bowlers. And I had one guy from the UK come out, Maurice Chambers, and I remember I said that the first thing I said before his first game for the University of Queensland, that, you know, about this, he's gone out to bowl and he said, "Casper, you know what?" He said, "That's true. What you said about the niggle worm, it's true." I said, "Is it? What happened?" He said, "Well, I came in a bowl and third ball in," he said, "I thought I tore my rib off the bone." He said, "But I kept bowling, and then all of a sudden it was fine." Now, I don't want to go against bowling workloads. I don't want to go against the latest medical advice and all that. I'm not encouraging everyone to bowl to your
snap. But do it, yes.
But I think the other thing I really, really want to sort of stress is that conveniently, there's pain is the biggest lesson. Perception is the other one we talked about.
Yeah.
And the third P I'm going to leave you with, the big three Ps, is possession or ownership of your journey. You can't leave anything to luck. There's so many things that's going to affect your performance that you have no control over. The pitch, the weather, umpires, you know, all have an effect on my performance as a bowler. It can, you know, and selectors will drop me again. But you can't actually rely on luck to happen. And you just, the quicker you decide and you realize it's the ownership, the possession of my journey, and whatever happens, happens, the better, because you don't want to get to the end of your days and just kick cans and blame people or blame anything for the fact that, put it this way, that you didn't make it or it didn't work. And at the end of the day, if you didn't have fun, it's your own fault.
So what you're saying is be the chairman of your game, and good luck in your role as chairman of Sports Corp. Good luck with the Smartball. Hopefully this is the start of a massive insight into what bowlers do with the cricket ball, the pace, the spin, the revolutions and everything like that. But Casper, mate, loved your work over the years, and we'll catch up soon and we'll finish with the Denicelli salute.
Love you too, Flynn.
Thanks, everybody. We'll catch up next week. Thanks, Casper.
Come on, buddy. What's up, buddy?
Oh, is it? Yeah.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.